Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. This is the podcast where you control the conversation right here at the Critically Acclaimed Network. I have no idea what that intro was. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a film critic. I write for The Wrap, and everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a film critic. I contribute to Slash Film, and that's it. That's all I do.
Okay.
I contribute to Slash Film.
You know what?
I guess for the purposes of this podcast, you can call me Rockmeister McCool.
You know what, Rockmeister McCool? You're enough. You're good enough. You're smart enough. And gosh darn it, people like you.
Oh, thank you. That's sweet of you to say.
You're sweet. Yeah, this is our podcast where we answer your letters and your emails and your stuff. So that's how that works. Mm-hmm. Here, how it works is very, very simple. You send us an email. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. That took me too long. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
Yeah, if you want to send us an actual physical letter, send it to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064. You can do that anytime.
Yeah, we strongly encourage you to do so. And we haven't done one of these in a hot little minute, so I'm sure we have a lot to catch up on. Whitney, why don't you take it away?
All right, here we got a letter from Daniel. Hello, Daniel.
Hi, Daniel.
It says, "Dear William Bibbiani and Whitney Seibold, do you have any good, fun, or interesting ideas for double features of movies that involve the same event or take place around the same time?" Some examples: The Post and All the President's Men, September 5 in Munich, Darkest Hour in Dunkirk, Saturday Night and the first episode of SNL. I know it's not a film, but still interesting.
Yeah.
Life of Brian and the Book of Clarence. That would be an interesting one.
That's a fun one.
I know there are probably a lot of war movies you could do this kind of double feature with, but I'm hoping to get your vast movie knowledge. You will have some good ideas outside of war movies. Thanks for the great podcast. Keep up the good work, Daniel.
That's a fun question. And Whitney and I are big, big fans of double features. We believe that double features are not only fun to watch, they are fun to program because you get to sort of comment on the topic itself and the quality of each movies and the way each movie sort of tackles each project. For example, one good one that I would highly recommend would be to watch Oliver Stone's Nixon, which was overshadowed by his movie JFK, but is an incredible production with amazing performances from Anthony Hopkins and Joan Allen. And is it's Oliver Stone when he was still at the height of his powers. And he was obviously dealing with Nixon's whole political career and, of course, the collapse into Watergate. As your double feature, I know the obvious answer might be All the President's Men, but nope, I'm going to recommend you watch Dick. Dick is a somewhat overlooked comedy from, I think, 1999, starring Michelle Williams and Kirsten Dunst as teenagers who become White House interns, and they're kind of daffy teenagers or silly young people who have no idea what they've stumbled into and end up A, feeding Nixon a lot of pot brownies, and B, accidentally becoming Deep Throat, which at the time this movie was made, the identity of Deep Throat was not common knowledge. So both films obviously take a hard stance that Nixon was, even if he was complicated, a real piece of shit. They do it in a much more, very tonally different ways. And so that's the first one that comes to mind.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I'm a big fan. I'm a huge advocate, in fact, of the idea of programming as a form of criticism. Mm-hmm. That you putting two movies next to each other, you're kind of commenting on what each one is saying about the other. And if that's the case, I would want to watch. Well, first of all, I wouldn't really want to watch it because I hate the movie. But the Dennis Quaid film Reagan.
Okay.
The biopic of Ronald Reagan. Mm-hmm. I would love to see that playing back to back with John Carpenter's They Live.
Ooh, that's good.
because those two movies are most certainly commenting on one another. They Live is a deep condemnation of the sort of crass commercialism and weird, insidious political power of just everything at the time. Yeah. Just this idea that money and advertising was all part of this like insidious alien plot, and everything that they're talking about in that movie is the stuff that was coming into being because of Reagan's policies. Mm. So watching this one movie, which is this completely disgusting hagiography of Reagan set right next to all of the horrors that his policies wrought, mm-hmm. would be fantastic to watch. I'd want to see that.
That's a good one. I was thinking in the sort of the Western vein, specifically films about so-called heroes of the Civil War. So I say so-called because the characters in these movies would argue maybe that they were not heroes. But Kevin Costner's Dances with Wolves, which isn't the greatest Western ever made by any stretch, but is better than it usually gets credit for, because it won Best Picture against Goodfellas, which in hindsight looks ridiculous. Even at the time, was ridiculous. But it is a strong movie, and it is an interesting film about a guy who is treated like a war hero, but what he really wants to do is get as far away from humanity as possible after the war. And I want to pair that up with the absolutely incredible horror movie Ravenous, which is basically the same thing, except with superpowered cannibals, where Guy Pearce is celebrated as a hero. He knows he's a fraud, and he wants to get as far away from humanity as possible, and he ends up on an outpost at the far, far western frontier, where, dang it, wouldn't you know it, if you eat people, you get superpowers. It's not everyone knows that. So that's a fun little historical
Something
tidbit.
I've always loved the conceit in from most cannibal movies that we're just delicious. Like the, it's a taboo, and it's only a taboo because we taste so good. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the only reason. And if you eat too much of us, you'll become like a vampire. Like it's
right. And
the taboo is pretty ridiculous when you think about it.
Surely it's all in the preparation, right? I mean, surely, like, you know, not just, you can't just like throw a person in a deep fryer and get the same thing as if you, like, you know, we've aged this ribeye in honey for 12 months. Like, I had another idea. Speaking of Dancing with Wolves beating Goodfellas, Goodfellas is based on the true story of a mafioso who had a very fascinating career and ended up sort of wasting away in witness protection, having lost all of the glamour that made him want to be a criminal. And around the same time that movie came out, another movie came out called My Blue Heaven, starring Steve Martin as a mafioso who, at the beginning of the movie, not the end, goes into witness protection. And the whole movie is this fish out of water thing about how a sharkskin suited, you know, sleazy, tacky mafia don is completely out of place in the suburbs of Southern California. And the gag is, however, and this is true, it's based on the same guy. It just picks up where Goodfellas left off. So just watch Goodfellas and then immediately go into My Blue Heaven, and it's fucking hilarious. Also, the movie is really good.
That's a
good
one.
Underrated film, I find.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of more like kind of Dark Mirror, like two sides of the same coin kind of thing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I mean, you could watch any sort of semi-period accurate Hamlet and Robert Eggers' The Northman, but those are kind of just different takes on, you know, a historical text, not necessarily an accurate tale of any particular sort. Intriguing. You could watch Shakespeare in Love, which is another film that I feel is a little underrated because it won Best Picture over a more popular movie, which is a fun, you know, full of in-jokes comedy romance about Shakespeare writing his own plays. And then you could watch Roland Emmerich's Anonymous, which is about how Shakespeare didn't do shit. Turns out Shakespeare was an illiterate cad who was just mooching off of his betters, who were, of course, the aristocracy. Only the aristocracy could have written Shakespeare's plays. Considering the sort of anti-aristocracy slant that Shakespeare in Love has, I think that's a pretty funny comparison. The King's Speech, another Best Picture winner that is not that underrated, but it's okay. That movie is about the King of England who becomes king after his brother abdicates the throne because he was he just really wanted to have sex with Wallace Simpson. And then you could watch Madonna's admittedly not good W.E., which is all about that love affair. And also this really embarrassing framing device in the modern day about people super inspired by that love affair between the then King of England and Nazi sympathizer. Anyway, that part is not focused on as much in W.E. now, is it? Is it now? I think there's some good ones. We should probably move on, but we would love if anyone has any particularly fun ones. By all means, please write in. Let us know. Let us know if we missed anything cool. I'm sure we did. We were going off the top of our heads. So anything that's like a particularly good contrast of things that are taking place at the same time, we'd love to see it. What do we got next week?
Let's see. Here's a letter from Wynn. Hello, Wynn.
Hi, Wynn.
Wynn says, hi, Bibbs and Ruckmeister McCool. Your most recent WGM, you posited that the first time travel story was The Time Machine. This is a misconception. And this was written a couple weeks back. If we count magic time travel, it happened for years with little to no explanation. The Time Machine is credited as the first science-based time travel story instead of it just being magic.
Fair enough.
There's the story called The Clock That Went Backward that came out in 1881, which I think was just like about a decade before The Time Machine.
Yeah, around there.
That a clock, the main character didn't make it. El Anacropete was written by Jaspar Fernandez y Avila in 1887. It was the first story wherein the main character builds a time machine. Mm-hmm. Anno 7603 is a play about the main characters being transported to the future where gender roles are reversed. Yeah. And it seems like it would be fun to act in. It was written in 1781.
Wow.
From what I can tell, it's in Danish. It seems like it would have been a fun satire to watch and act in.
That's fun.
Let's see. Myth and religion also have some time travel stories. There's stories in Hinduism. The story of King Raivita Kakudi, the Mahabharata, has time travel in it.
That's very cool.
The Seven Sleepers and the Isra of Miraj are Islamic stories that have time travel in them. And Honi HaMagel from Judaism is a time travel story.
That's very cool.
A couple of religious examples where the character falls asleep and doesn't age and wakes up to see the future. I've decided to count as time travel. I suppose I'm counting sleeping for a long time. The Young Shipwright, a.k.a. The 300 Years Hence, written by Mary Griffith, is about a man who is buried in a garden due to an explosion and wakes up 300 years later.
Oh.
Also, philosophical question is, A Christmas Carol, is that a time travel story?
Yes.
If you read it as the spirits entering his dream, which I feel has a solid read in it. Anyway, all our yesterdays win.
Thank you.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah,
those are all of all time travel.
Yeah,
stories.
We were, I think, sort of subconsciously focusing on time travel as a science fiction element. I have posited before, and I'm a little embarrassed I didn't bring it up when this came up, that A Christmas Carol is absolutely a time travel story. Even if it's just revisiting the past without being able to change it, I do believe that it is functionally someone looking into the past and looking into at least the possible future. So I don't know how it could be anything else. I also, while we are talking about sort of fantastical versions, Rip Van Winkle, about 1819.
It's a Washington Irving story.
Yeah, a guy magically falls asleep. The thing is that if you want to get really technical about it, almost every story ever told is a time travel story. It's just that you're traveling consistently forward at the same pace. And if you think about it further, if you go to like motion picture editing, for example, or even just cutting between timelines or not covering every second of everyone's day in a book, we're constantly manipulating time in our stories in order to convey a narrative, but that's just for the reader's benefit or the viewer's benefit.
Every film condenses time in some significant way.
Unless it takes place entirely in real time, which a few do.
But those are very rare, aren't they?
Yes, they do. I'm just saying, not technically every, but yes, the vast majority do manipulate time in some way. And of course, anytime we or anybody else says that anything was the first anything, we're probably wrong. There's probably at least an asterisk next to something ahead of time, because nothing exists in a vacuum. I think it was Mark Twain who said something along the lines of the only people who could have ever claimed to have had an original idea were like Adam and Eve, like, right. Which of course, you know, religion, but you know, before there were people to find anything that was completely uninfluenced by other people and what they have done or accomplished. Yeah. So, but it's always fun to learn about these things. And I love, you know, I think one of the best ways to learn about cinema or anything else is to find something you love and then find out what begat that. Here's the movie you love. What was that filmmaker inspired by? Cool. Watch those movies. What were those filmmakers inspired by? Cool. Watch those movies. And pretty soon, a couple of generations later, you've got a pretty working knowledge of a big chunk of motion picture history. And I think that's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. If you go back far enough, I've always taken a great deal of delight in the fact that the oldest story currently known to humankind, like the one written earliest, was the Epic of Gilgamesh, written in ancient Sumerian. And the first sentence of the oldest story we know was, he had seen everything. Like, we're starting at the end of the story. I think that's great. I love that.
I'm really fond of a line they repeat in Battlestar Galactica. I don't remember if it's in the original series, but it's in the reboot series, which is, all of this has happened before, and all of this will happen again.
Nice.
Which is very poetic. I don't know exactly where it's from. I'm sure someone's already writing an email explaining it. But in any case, thank you. We always love a correction. We do. Sometimes we're like, ah, dang, I should have known that. But like, seriously, we want to learn and we want to share the knowledge. So thank you. Always, always interested in a correction. What's our next email?
Our next email comes from Marcus. It says, Dear Bibs and Wits, I just started listening again for the first time since 2019. I had a child, and some of my hobbies fell by the wayside as my priorities changed. Anyways, my love for movies was recently reignited after watching 1960s The Apartment while on a plane. I remember it being on my watch list back when I was watching movies a lot and decided to give it a try. Good movie.
Yeah, I agree, yeah.
Yeah, I'll say so. My question to you is, what is the best movie you watched for the first time on an airplane? Second question, do you guys have a Letterboxd account? Or what is the best way to see your reviews? Thank you for continuing to do the pod. Sincerely, Marcus. Well, as for the airplane movies, I went on a business trip to Florida kind of recently, so I had a lot of time on a plane, but I had failed to grab a pair of headphones
to listen to
a movie. So what I did was I found a movie that I was very familiar with and decided to see what the experience would be like if I watched that whole movie without any sound and just watching the subtitles.
Right.
So I chose The Wizard of Oz, a movie I've seen 100 times.
Sure.
That was a very unusual experience because that's a musical. There's songs in it. There's all of the audio is just sort of echoing in my brain. And because I've seen it so much, I think I didn't even really need to. It was just sort of like looking at a picture of an old friend in that case.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're filling in the gaps mentally, yeah. That's an old critical studies trick, where, especially if you want to study things like visual storytelling, cinematography, editing in particular, take a movie and just remove all the sound, because sound smooths out a lot. Sound smooths out transitions. Sound is able to fill in gaps in narrative that you forgot to film or just planned to convey in sound in the first place. And not every movie functions like, for example, a silent movie, where everything was visually designed. You know, a lot of them are better than others, but everything was specifically designed to work without sound. So everything had to be very, very clear. I had a similar experience on an airplane. This was many years ago, and I didn't, I think I couldn't, it was back when you had to like pay for headphones, and I couldn't afford them, or I just didn't have the money or whatever. But the person next to me was watching something, and I had never seen Marley and Me, which is a book starring, it's based on a book, stars Owen Wilson as a guy who gets a dog. The dog is very, very wonderful. And unfortunately, it's a movie about a dog. So unless it's like specifically Beethoven and like very, very cutesy, bad things often happen to the dog in dog movies, like an Old Yeller, Turner and Hooch, etc.
Yeah.
So I'm watching this movie, and I'm finding that although, you know, it doesn't seem to be terribly rich and complicated narrative storytelling, it was very clear. All of the emotions were coming out in a very, very concise, very effective way. That is just a cleanly told narrative. And I think, honestly, there's a decent chance I appreciate Marley and Me more because that was my introduction than if I had probably seen it with sound, which I know emotionally manipulative may or may not work. But, like, you know, that was, I had a lot of respect for Marley and Me just right off the bat. The correct answer for me, though, the best movie I ever watched on an airplane was Geostorm.
Oh, that is a perfect airplane kind of a movie.
I was flying back from somewhere. I don't fucking know. But I was on a particularly long plane ride from the East Coast to the West Coast. And the only movies that appealed to me that they had available were junk. So I watched, what was that? I think was it King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, whichever one Guy Ritchie did.
Oh, God, which was, that's a terrible movie.
The whole movie is made up of like montages. Just every other scene is a bunch of stuff happening all at once and nothing actually moving forward or making sense. It's just a bad movie. But then I followed that up with Geostorm, which is an incredibly inane movie. Just absolute nonsense. And even by the standards of, like, Dean Devlin directed it, and he was the writer for a lot of Roland Emmerich's more popular films like Independence Day. And, yeah, he was clearly trying to get that Independence Day magic going. And it's just, we found a way to cure the world's weather problems by controlling them with satellites. But oh no, the satellites broke. And now we have a geostorm. And now the president is being rescued by the scientist's brother and his Secret Service girlfriend, who's played exactly like she would play a Terminator, which I love. She's an incredible performance. And we're like just outrunning lightning. And it's just, this is the fucking best movie. It's just the best movie.
The problem is that the kind of movies, like the kind of junk I would want to see on an airplane if I only have access to like ginger ale nuts and like really shitty gin, like the kind of movie I would want to watch in that scenario, I couldn't watch on a plane because I'd want them to have like a lot of gore and nudity.
Right.
And I don't think they offer those kinds of films on those little seat back screens.
Yeah, no, like I totally get it. Like watching, I don't know, some, like watching Bumblebee isn't even gonna get you back to normal. You need a much more powerful shot for you in particular. I totally get that. one last note before we move on. The last time I was on an airplane, I noticed that hey, they have Citizen Kane on this airplane.
Yeah, that's really cool. They started to put like actual classics on these airplanes.
Our listener watched The Apartment, which is a great movie. But Citizen Kane was there, and I'm like, you know what I'm going to do? I'm going to watch Citizen Kane. Citizen Kane never gets old. Citizen Kane's a great movie. I might as well watch a good movie while I'm on an airplane. And I'm watching it, and I realize something is incredibly wrong.
Okay.
They chopped it to widescreen.
Oh, shoot. They matted it.
Yeah. So, like, before
they cut off the top and bottom of the screen.
If anyone doesn't know what I'm talking about, before the 1950s, movies were pretty much universally presented in what we call Academy ratio, which isn't a perfect square, but is close enough.
Yeah.
It's essentially a square. And then in the 50s, they popularized widescreen in 102, helped sort of compete with television, which was becoming more and more ubiquitous. And so, like, yeah, see our movie in giant widescreen. You can see more picture. Ha, ha, ha. And then they started eventually in the 90s, they started popularizing widescreen TVs. And so the practice of cropping films to a square from widescreen to a square was quickly phased out in favor of showing everything in widescreen, or preferably its original aspect ratio. But someone in their finite wisdom decided that everything would look better in widescreen. Nobody likes black bars on the side of your screen, so we're just going to cut off a third of Citizen Kane. And I was under the impression...
Great. Thanks a lot.
I was under the distinct impression in the 1980s, they threatened to colorize Citizen Kane. And it turned out in Orson Welles' contract that he didn't just have director's cut in Citizen Kane. He had director's cut in perpetuity throughout the universe, essentially. No one could touch it. No one could colorize it. It was forbidden. Which I'm pretty sure also means you're not allowed to cut it to fucking widescreen. So I feel like the airline, I remember it was Delta or some shit, I feel like the airline I was on could be sued for that, and a part of me really wants them to be, because god damn it, dude.
There's a movie in that. That's airplanes. But there was also a second part to this letter. Do we have a letterboxed, and how's the best way to see our reviews? That's some practical stuff that we can just sort of let some of our newer listeners know.
Sure.
Because we don't have a letterbox, do we? Or is...
we created one for the podcast, and it quickly fell into disuse because I had to run that thing, and I am bad at that. I don't curate and catalog that way. And a lot of people, listen, I love Letterboxd. I got nothing against Letterboxd, but Letterboxd is for people who want to keep track of every single thing that they're watching, and also share what they're watching with other people, and write reviews. Sometimes short reviews, sometimes long reviews, and that's really, really great. I write my reviews on other publications, so spending a lot of time writing them for Letterboxd doesn't make a lot of sense for me. I also remember that when Letterboxd was becoming particularly popular, I was playing the movie trivia Schmodown, and if I cataloged every single movie I was watching, all of the other competitors would get a leg up on me, because, uh-oh, he's studying up on the Fast and Furious movies, I'd better study up on those,
that's
too.
That's true.
That was a fun and weird era in our lives. So yeah, I'm not on Letterboxd, but it is pretty easy to find my reviews. The majority of my reviews in print for most of my career are on Rotten Tomatoes, and you can go to my author page on Rotten Tomatoes. I think it's just rottentomatoes.com/author/William-Bibbiani. But you can just look it up on Google, William Bibbiani, Rotten Tomatoes, and you can see, obviously, the most recent are first, but it goes back pretty far. So a lot of the early reviews are no longer... they're dead links now because the sites went under, unfortunately. But that's probably the best way if you just want to read my reviews. But Rotten Tomatoes only catalogs reviews. So if I wrote a top 10 list, it's not on there. So you can go to my author page at The Wrap as well. You can check that out. I've written for a lot of other publications as well, but less consistently. You can try to check out my name at Bloody Disgusting. I wrote for there for a while. I wrote for Slash Film for a while, like you, although you went career. The author page at the publications where you've seen our work is a good place to start. But Rotten Tomatoes is a particularly good aggregate of just our links.
That is true. You can go to because I write for Slash Film, we each have an author page. You can go to I think it's just slashfilm.com/author/Whitney Seibold, and you can find all my things.
And how many things are there, Whitney?
Oh, so many. I write about 4 articles a day these days. Right. It's a bunch.
My point is, what I think recently you told me you think you figured out the number, or at least you recently crossed a big threshold.
Oh, yeah. I recently submitted. I submitted my first article to Slash Film in November of 2021, and since then I have I've contributed 5,000 articles to that website.
Thousand articles.
That's 5,000.
What would you say if you were to guess? And I know it varies. If you were to guess the average length of those articles, what would you say? What would you say it averages out to?
Uh, because we write the everything's structured in a very specific way over at Slash Films. So, each of my articles has to be like between 500 and 850 words, although a lot of them are a lot longer than that.
Yeah. So why don't we just say let's just say 800 as an average, just uh-huh. Just because we don't. Yeah. Prepare. And so that is 4 million words.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Yeah. Yeah. Which is, I'm pretty sure that's like the equivalent of like quite a few novels at this point. And that's just all there at Slash Film. It's a compendium of Whitney's wisdom and wit and insights. And I highly recommend you check it out because you can learn a lot about film history. You can learn a lot of, you can learn a hell of a lot about Gilligan's Island and Star Trek. That's for sure.
Oh gosh. Yeah. I'm kind of the resident Star Trek guy. In fact, I was just put in charge of a regular column called Trekspertise, which delves into like the really nerdy stuff, like, how dilithium crystals actually work inside an engine. And I have this great book from the 90s called the Star Trek The Next Generation Technical Manual. And Rick Sternbach and Mike Okuda, the technical advisors on the show, just put together everything, like the actual imaginary physics that went into every single piece of imaginary tech on the show. It's really handy when I'm writing these articles. And but, you know, mine has a little bit more more wit to them.
Well, yeah, because you're Whitney. Anyway, but thank you for asking those really great questions. Whitney, why don't we move on? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, let's see. Here's our next letter. This one comes from... This one's a little bit long. It comes from Mark. And Mark says, Bibs and... And there's three emojis. A rock, a king, the Scottish flag, and a snowflake.
Nice. Rockmeister McCool. Very, very nice.
Rockmeister McCool, yeah.
Do you remember, I think it was the Rankin Bass special... I think it was Here Comes Santa Claus. It was the origin of Santa Claus. And the villain was Burgermeister Meisterburger. Because he was the Burgermeister. He was the Burgermeister. And his last name was Meisterburger. And I think that's one of the funniest names anyone's ever come up with. What's the guy? So what's the letter?
I have been meaning to email you for many years at this point, but have struggled to get my thoughts down on paper or, you know, on screen. However, that idiom goes in a tech-connected world. Either way, I keep meaning to send video game recommendations to Whitney, who's professed a narrow taste in video games, actually hurt my soul whenever they come up. Whitney's query one time about the scoring system in Unpacking, a game that is extremely meditative, coming-of-age exploration of a young woman's life through the items she keeps between moves, was a question akin to asking when the fight scene will happen in Persona.
That's well said, yeah.
Of course, it's only because the pair of you opened my mind to the vastness of cinema that I could even describe Persona, else I would have been told you that Persona is a Japanese RPG series about school kids fighting monsters, but I digress.
Hey-o.
This is not that email. You are safe from me semi-coherently rambling about video games for now. Mm. In the most recent You've Got Mail, at least of the time of writing, I forgot to press send, so you may have recorded another one by now. You said you should have a critically acclaimed board game, and a common game format immediately came to my mind. Mm. And then immediately left my mind because I was busy at work packing freshly baked bread, as is my wont. But something triggered my memory this morning, and somehow I managed to dash off this entirely unplaytested and unproofread variant of a common card game format.
What?
The critically acclaimed game.
Ooh.
Okay, this is going to be interesting.
I want to hear it.
Inspired by Apples to Apples, Snake Oil, and Cards Against Humanity. What do you need? A pack of small blank index cards, three or more players, and a good knowledge of films. Set up. Split the pack of index cards between the players sort of evenly. On each card, the players write the name of a film they have seen and find interesting, then place those cards face down in a pile in the middle of the table. Once everyone has run out of index cards, the movies they can think of, or patience, shuffle the pile and discard any blank cards. Deal each player... Sorry, I lost a little bit. Deal each player a hand of six cards... At this point, the players have the option to remove any films from their hands they are unfamiliar with and return those cards to the bottom of the deck, then draw back up to six. If any of the newly drawn cards are also films they aren't familiar with, it will draw, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, make sure your hands
read through Wikipedia or Letterboxd. Yeah. Ask the player who wrote the card or simply feign knowledge or bluff their way through the game. Gameplay. The player who most recently watched a movie in a theater goes first.
Cute.
If one or two more players were at the same screening, it is the player who's sitting on the left. Okay. This player is the critic.
Ooh.
Ooh, okay. I like this so far. The critic chooses a card from their hands, reads it out, and either briefly describes the film to the best of their knowledge or asks whoever wrote the card. Sorry, my eyes are going to do so. Going clockwise around the table, each player chooses a card from their hand, places it in front of them, and tries to explain why their film would make a great second half of a double feature when combined with the critic's film.
Oh, that's good.
Ooh, I like this. This is really fun.
Oh, we're going to do this. We're really going to do this. This is a great idea for a game. I love this.
Yeah, this is fantastic.
How fortuitous is really that the first question we asked in this We've Got Mail was about our love of double features.
Was about double
Very
features, yeah.
Very thematically appropriate. That's great.
This explanation can be critical, technical, philosophical, emotional, ironic, comedic, or even or as creative as the player wishes. Essentially, anything goes, short of threats or bribery.
That's really great.
Once all players have proposed their double features, the critic chooses the one they feel is the best. Similarly, they may judge on any criteria they want, short of favoritism or payola. The winning player takes the critic's card, places it on top of their own played card, and puts the played cards to one side. All the other players place their played cards in a discard pile. The winning player is now the critic. Gameplay repeats until all games are played. Oh, I like this game.
That's a really
this
fun
This is great, because I already know how to play it.
Yeah.
I figured it out already.
No, that's a really, really good system. And yeah, obviously it's derivative of Apple's, is it Apples to Apples is what it's called?
Cards Against Humanity, those kinds of games.
Yeah, which is fine. I think that's a perfectly acceptable play style. I don't think that's, I don't think it's close enough to any of those to run the risk of feeling, like been there, done that. But yeah, that's really, really, and it's so simple too. Just get the index cards. Everyone write the names of movies that they've seen or feel like they can do, and then divvy them up. That's really clever. We are totally gonna play that game.
and there's a little bit more. Okay. The end of the game, once the final round has ended and all cards have been played, the players count how many they have. The player with the most double features wins and is critically acclaimed.
Nice.
In the case of a tie, all tied players are critically acclaimed.
Oh, that's nice.
The critically acclaimed players look through all of the double features and decide on a favorite. The players now have to choose to either watch that double feature, play the game again, or just do something else entirely.
I do like that you have to watch that. I hope that's a fun idea.
Yeah, actually watching it at the end is a good way to fill the whole evening.
Yeah.
I hope that you at least find this of some interest. In the unlikely event that it brings some level of joy and or entertainment, let it be known that it cannot equal 1/1,000,000,000 of the entertainment and enlightenment you have provided me over the years. Your gentlemen have done nothing but expand my horizons and make me consider art that I never would have done otherwise for just shy of a decade. And for that, I only have the most sincere praise, Mark.
Well
thank you, Mark. And that is a great game.
That's really fun.
Okay, this... We're going to call this Mark Cope's critically acclaimed card game. We have to give him full credit because this is his idea.
Okay. Did Mark give his full name in the email? Because I don't want to...
Yes, it was signed off Mark Cope.
Okay, just want to make sure. Because if we give your name based on the name that you write down. If you leave it anonymous, we leave it anonymous. If you say Philandering in Philadelphia, we would call you that. Weird choice, but there you go. Or if you give your name, you give your name. It's fine. I just want to make sure that we were saying the right thing. But you should get credit for that. And that is a really good game. And I totally sign off on that. That's really fun. And we are definitely going to do that. And we will try to report back. I don't know how fast we can get to that, but it's really, really fun idea. We're totally
going to
do
like
it.
Yeah, I like that idea a lot.
That's really great. Okay. Well, thank you for that. That was cool. That was tight. I love that. Okay. What do we got? What do we got next?
Let's see. Here's a letter from Shad. Hello, Shad. And it's a Star Trek letter.
One of our favorites.
Hey guys, after having to take a break from the Patreon due to some health related bills, I am back. Oh, I'm sorry about your health related bills.
Very sorry to hear about
those are never fun.
No.
I'm back. I am catching up on the episode and wanted to leave some information on the episode Force of Nature. Oh, that's the episode of Next Generation where they can't go faster than warp 5.
Oh, yeah.
Like they that's the one where they realize that their warp engines are like damaging to a certain area of space.
Yeah.
And Federation says you now can't go faster than warp 5.
It is
because that's
It was an episode that came out.
It's supposed to be an environmental episode.
Yeah, it was an episode that came out in the early 90s. And in the early 90s, people were really finally starting to rally together and realize that fossil fuels and things like aerosol cans were extremely damaging to the environment. And people were calling for legislation and other forms of incentives to curb those emissions in order to heal the ozone layer, make the air more breathable, all that kind of stuff. And they thought it would be interesting to do a Star Trek episode in which they found out that simply traveling at warp, the thing that they have to do in order to travel.
But the show is predicated on,
What if that was deleterious to the environment of space itself? And so they had to start actually thinking about reserving that resource and being very careful with how they used it, which I think is an interesting idea on paper, not very well told dramatically in the episode, interesting idea on paper, but also pretty much only got in the way, and they only went back to it a couple of times. But I suspect it's something Chen wants to talk about. What's the rest of the letter?
Well, you pointed out to me that after that, they started, instead of saying like warp one, they would say maximum warp, which is something I didn't even really notice.
Yeah, like whatever is the best available to us. It kind of just covered all the bases.
Yeah. Anyway, they only mention the warp 5 limitation once more during The Next Generation, and that's during the episode The Pegasus. They never mention it on Deep Space Nine, but the technical manual for Voyager states that the folding nacelles were designed to help alleviate the warp field issue. We haven't gotten to Star Trek Voyager yet, but the ship, when it's traveling at sublight speeds, is folded, like, kind of flat. But when it goes to warp, the nacelles fold up into a different configuration, and then it zips off to warp.
Yeah, it's a neat design. It looks cool, and I do like that they... Because Voyager was considered like a top-of-the-line experimental ship. It had this cool kind of, like, living technology in it. Like, wasn't there, like, moss or something in it that, like...
It was just, like, yeah, it was... it wasn't moss, but it was, like, organic... there was like an organic compound in the computer gel packs.
Yeah.
Like they could store information in this kind of liquid state. And I thought that was pretty cool.
Yeah. It's much like in the later episodes of MST3K, Mystery Science Theater 3000, where movies are not kept on DVDs or on film strips. They are kept in tubes of water.
Like the information is stored in the liquid somehow.
Yeah, which is fun. So I wasn't aware that that was the justification for that. And I think that's great because one of the things we've been postulating is that in a utopian society like the one espoused in Star Trek, not always achieved, but espoused, they would want to fix that. They would want to do something about that. And surely they would make making warp travel safe a top priority. And maybe the reason why they didn't keep mentioning it was because they fixed it, which is a good idea. Probably would have been even better to point that out in the text, you know, because if we're talking about utopias, like they're always bragging about how they're post-capitalism. What if they were post-environmental waste? Great.
That'd be great.
Brag about that too.
Shad continues to say, they never say exactly how the folding nacelles help. It's just one line of information and now we don't ever have to talk about it. Personally, I think they added a Tamsarian filter, and that's what solved the problem. That's a Simpsons reference, Principal Skinner's real name is Armin Tamsarian.
Yeah, but at the end of the episode where we found out he wasn't the real Principal Skinner, they made it illegal to mention that he's not the real Principal Skinner so that they never have to reference that plot point ever again.
That's right.
Brutal.
Because that wasn't in the show, it's just in a technical manual, only nerds like us are going to be saying, oh, well, you know, actually.
But it's useful information.
They covered that problem.
I think it's useful information. Yeah. I think, you know, they brought up a big thing and then they just kind of dropped it. And it's nice to know that somewhere, even if it's just jotted down in a book somewhere, someone was like, no, we got that. That's fine. You don't have to worry about that. It's a little more, because it's just a technical thing, because it's just a little blip. It's a lot more satisfying than saying somehow Palpatine returned, which feels like it should be like a huge plot point. It should have been built up for two movies or whatever. But if they were just like, oh, hey, how did we fix the Millennium Falcon's, you know, hyperdrive? That went there and that went there and we're good. Okay, great. Yeah, I think we can all get behind that. That's not a big deal. So that's nice. Well, thank you. Thank you for that bit. Yeah. Thank you for that tidbit. That's good trivia.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Glad to be back listening to the show. And please, when you get to Star Trek Generations, the movie, do a full-length commentary on that one. I was at a Star Trek convention in Tulsa, Oklahoma, just after that movie came out. And the author of The Nitpicker's Guide to Next Generation Trekkers, Phil Farrand, was there. And he did an entire panel about how the errors... in Generations, it was a room full of Trekkies ripping it apart, one movie for a solid hour. It was glorious.
Yeah, that sounds about right.
Thanks for all you do, Shad. Yeah,
we can probably do a commentary track for Generations. We'll try to remember it. There's a decent chance we'll space out because that's at least a few months away. But yeah, that's a good idea. That's fun. Generations is a weird flick.
Yeah, Generations came at like a weird time in my fandom because I was like deeper into Star Trek than I ever was. And so that movie came out and I'm watching it multiple times in the theater and I'm talking about it with friends. And it's like I didn't even really give a thought to its quality. I didn't think it was like, is it a good movie? Is it a bad movie? I didn't even really care. It's just it's a Star Trek movie and this is the thing in front of me and that's what I'm going to obsess about.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. And the thing is with Generations is that they kind of just had a good hook, you know, Picard and Kirk meet and team up at some point.
Yeah.
But A, that only happens right at the end of the movie. And B, they didn't think out the rest of the movie. There's got to be a reason to get to there. You got to be excited until then. And they just kind of filled it with just like, hey, Data never got his emotion chip. That'll fill time. Like, no, you have to tell a story, guys. You have to tell a good story.
It's the phenomenon of we had to give them something to do. Like this is the movie. We got to do something special. So
I'm very curious how the Mandalorian and Grogu is going to turn out in that regard, because have you watched that show, Whitney, at all?
No, I haven't seen a single frame of that.
Yeah, I'd seen some of it and then I caught up. I just finished actually catching up because I'm going to see the movie in a couple of days. But that show is, A, it looks very cinematic. You know, they do a bunch of stuff that you would normally only get to see in movie theaters because it's so expensive and visual effects heavy. But also, like, every episode is like its own little kind of mini movie. And I'm thinking to myself, the line between what The Mandalorian does on TV and what justifies making a feature film, like what kind of leap justifies, okay, now we need to see this one in theaters, is a very different, I think, than going from like a network television budget to like a $75 million blockbuster.
Yeah.
So I'm curious if they're going to, it may or may not be good. I'm curious if they're going to be able to make the spectacle worthwhile and set it aside from the show. It's like, no, this is the movie. The movie was really good. So we'll see how it goes. But thank you for writing it.
Yeah. Here's another letter.
Great.
This one comes from Mirror Universe Harry Mudd. I think this is another Star Trek letter.
Okay. That sounds like it.
Gentle beings, I've been enjoying your coverage of TNG DS9.
Yay!
And would like to clear up some miscontractions that come up during your rewatch.
Oh, that's a good name. I wish I'd thought of that. Miscontractions. Damn it.
Yeah, that
copyright. That
sounds
that's
like
so
something
good.
You'd be into.
Yeah. Anyway.
I have included several pauses for you, Bibbs, to comment on the premise I suggest.
All right, someone's been paying attention to how this works.
Yeah. With that in mind, please enjoy my explanation for why Deep Space Nine technology doesn't behave the same way as Federation tech. The Enterprise is a Starfleet's flagship and one of the most advanced Federation vessels in service as of Star Trek The Next Generation. Deep Space Nine takes place on a non-Federation station using technology from multiple non-Federation manufacturers. There's no reason holosuites and Federation holodecks have operate identically any more than Android and Apple devices do.
Okay. All right. Interesting point. We knew that the space station was built by the Cardassians. And we've talked about that a lot. But Cardassians have different design specifications. They work on different frequencies, yada, yada, yada. It's not the same tech. But pointing out that, like, that probably applies to tech all over the ship is probably something I don't think we've addressed directly, and is a good point.
Yeah, and he says, that also explains why Quark's hollow suite seems to have fewer safeguards. Federation rules don't necessarily apply on a Bajoran station run partly by a Ferengi business. Entering someone else's hollow suite program might be illegal in the Federation, but Quark is not exactly known for strict compliance standards. Pause for discussion.
Okay, I'll take you right there. I'll just say this right now. To be fair, the Federation doesn't have great, like, regulations on the holodeck either, man. Like, they just really don't. That thing is constantly breaking, endangering lives, creating new life, being used to be weird and creepy about your coworkers, or fall in love with a real person, but like a fake AI version of them. So it really messes you up when you meet them. Like, the holodeck is kind of gross, actually, in the way it tends to, whenever it breaks, anyway.
Yeah, it's a little messed up, isn't it?
Yeah. So I'm just saying, I think quarks are probably designed to be naughtier by nature. No pun intended. Not that wasn't really a pun, more just a casual reference. But I think we're giving Starfleet a little too much credit for saying that there's a regulated. But fair enough. Yeah, that's a good point.
Let's see. You could ask, why would the holodeck even allow real person simulations if that can obviously be abused? Because Starfleet assumes its officers are professionals. The system runs partly on trust and social norms. Creating sexualized replicas of real co-workers is considered creepy, unethical, and deeply inappropriate behavior in a Federation culture. The technology exists because there are legitimate uses for it. Mm. For example, when Troi runs the Kobayashi Maru command test, the emotional impact comes from sacrificing Geordi specifically. And we haven't gotten to that episode yet.
Oh, okay, that's cool.
That's from the episode Thine Own Self. That's coming up pretty shortly. Mm. The scenario only works because the simulation uses real people that the subject knows personally. Pause to discuss.
Okay, no, that's an interesting point. I think even in an idealized society like Starfleet, that's not how rules work. We have rules to cover worst case scenarios and the people who would, like, there's a reason why we outlaw murder, right? Theoretically, we all agree that murder is bad, and yet it keeps happening. Funny. We make sure that is clearly on the books as something we do not approve of, unless, of course, we're executing a murderer, which is, hypocritical, but that's a whole bag of worms. That's how rules work. We make rules to cover the people who would break rules or the situations in which those rules might be broken. Who is the comedian? There's some comedian who was talking about this, and he was just like, listen, I do drugs like a champion. But, like, someone else is just like, oh, you're ruining it for everybody because you're not responsible with your addictive drugs. Like, that's not how that works. So I still think they need regulations. And I think we discussed this once. I think the idea that commanding officers would probably have different restrictions. I don't know if, like, the barber on the Enterprise needs to create, like, perfect replicas. Maybe how about this? What if there isn't a damn good reason for it, and I think only, like, command should have the access to that, you're only allowed to create imperfect replicas of people. Like, they don't look quite right, or they look kind of low res, or their voice is a little bit off, so that you couldn't, like, copy their voice pattern and, give someone a false order on the ship. I think that might actually.
How about this? They have a big, they have a big letter H on their forehead for hologram.
Okay.
Like on Red Dwarf.
That would be funny. That would be funny. By the way, I think everyone is required to take a drink every time I complain about the holodecks.
That's all this letter.
You're just chugging it. You're just chugging a big old canteen of whiskey at this point.
Anyway, but Mirror Harry, what is up with Barkley? I'd argue that Barkley isn't making perfect duplicates of the senior staff. He's making exaggerated fantasy analogs, just like you were saying, with just enough cosmetic changes to create plausible deniability. Riker wasn't Riker. He was short Riker. Or Geordi shared his access code one time and Barkley abused it. Who can say? Pause to discuss.
Yeah, no, I don't think his... Here's what I think. I think that if you're creating a duplicate of someone who is real, still alive, and especially someone who's like a crew member on the ship, like a coworker or something like that, I think they should be derezzed to like Virtua Fighter graphics.
Like, just like they look like polygons.
Yeah, they should look like the Money for Nothing music video. Like they should just like recognizable in sort of like a cartoon kind of abstract way, but not actually convincing. I think they need to be like, it's like when they changed the voice of Kermit, like the new current voice of Kermit is like the wrong Kermit. Like, it's just like, you're not even close to Kermit. Like, I understand you're not going to be exactly the same as the old Kermits, but, and it'd be one thing if it was like a totally different take and it kind of worked, but it was like, no, you're just not Kermit. Like, if you wanted to make a holodeck simulation where you teamed up with Picard to like go treasure hunting, he should look like PS1 graphics of Picard, and two, he should sound like not Kermit.
Okay.
Yeah. That's got to be good enough for
And
you,
finally, I think it's hard to say, because what if you create a clearly, Barkley, though, is like going into personnel files, because the computer has the images of the senior staff like in its file somewhere. Right. So the computer can create those people. You probably couldn't just go in and create someone from scratch and accidentally make it look exactly like them. Right.
I think that would be extremely hard to do. You would have to be doing it on purpose. I mean, I guess you could do it subconsciously, like, oh, that looks a little like Riker. But like, I don't think you would come up with anything nearly that exact if you were just, if you hit randomize. I don't think that would be a thing.
Yeah. Anyway, finally, the ending of A Fistful of Data's with Worf kissing a female version of Data. I don't endorse Worf's horror because it's supposed to be gay. I don't endorse Worf's horror is supposed to be gay panic. Worf is honorable and deeply uncomfortable with the idea that he was forced to have a romantic encounter with a holographic version of his crewmate without their consent. From his perspective, that's humiliating and dishonorable, and in front of his son, no less. Pause to discuss. That's actually a good point. We criticized that point because it looked like a gay panic joke. That, oh no, Worf is going to have to like be kind of snuggly and might have to kiss a man, and that's what was making him comfortable. But no, that's a good point. He the fact that it was a friend of his was what made it uncomfortable.
He was fine with shooting all the other Datas, though.
Yes, but that he's taking their lives in honorable combat. That okay, also right, keeping,
you know,
with
his Worf, ethos. For Worf, I can see that kind of tracks.
Yeah,
it's listen. there's a concept in Marvel Comics called the No Prize. Where you acknowledge that there is some kind of inconsistency or logical fallacy, or this character shouldn't have been wearing this costume in this era, yada yada yada. But instead of just complaining, hey, that's wrong, you have to come up with a workaround, a reason why that makes sense. And if you can do that, you win a no prize. For Fistful of Data, you win a no prize. That's a good no prize.
All right. I can work with that. All right. Now, yes, the scene is absolutely gay panic and written like a 1990s sitcom style sexuality joke, but Michael Dorn is 100% deserves a more charitable read than Worf freaked out because gay.
Yeah, fair enough.
Please let me know if you'd like to address the cloaking device. It's not nearly as long as this treatise. Oh, sure. Definitely in something about the cloaking device.
Oh, yeah. No, we got to do it because there was recently an episode that we covered on All Our Yesterdays, which is on our Patreon page, where there was a whole episode about how the Federation's enemies often have cloaking devices. Their spaceships are invisible in space. Mm. Why doesn't the Federation have that? And the reasons are
unclear.
They're unclear, or they're not terribly convincing. It's pretty obvious that they made that as an arbitrary like story decision to just sort of make sure that the Enterprise has at least something akin to a weakness. They've struggled to justify it in the continuity of the show, because in the continuity of the show, not entirely sure that makes sense. Mm. But yeah, send us that email. We'd love to read it. I think we have time for one more.
Hold on. There's a PS here. There's a little postscript. First of all, it says Love Snack Fam.
Yay.
that's my wife's podcast. My wife and my son try limited edition snacks. They have their own podcast now. So look up Snack Fam podcast.
Yeah, you can find the first couple of episodes on our feed, but you can also go to the Snack Fam podcast. It's a separate podcast, not related to ours, other than, like, you know, biologically. But it's its own thing, and we have a link at the bottom of our descriptions of our most recent episodes. Head on over there, subscribe, don't miss a single snack.
And postscript, the real reason why Kirk didn't save Edith Keeler is because of the Temporal Prime Directive. Why did he take Gillian Taylor and voyage home? Because they changed the Temporal Prime Directive. I can do this all day.
That's a little thin, but okay, I'll let it go. I don't know if they had a Temporal Prime Directive yet. I feel like in the original series, when they went back in time the first time, it was considered quite unexpected and novel, not something that we had a lot of rules pre-existing about. So, I don't know. Interesting thought. All right, I think we have time for one more letter, I think.
Okay, here's one more letter. This one comes from Jesse. Hello, Jesse.
Hi, Jesse.
Hello, my two favorite critics.
Hi.
A while ago on We've Got Mail, you read a letter from my grandmother using your platform as an interface to get me to watch The Towering Inferno.
Yay! I'm glad we get a follow-up of this.
Oh, we get a little follow-up on this one. Okay, I love it. For what it's worth, getting my name in the title of an episode was my favorite podcast, and it's a great way to do just about anything.
Yay!
To be honest, I'm not sure why I didn't take her advice sooner. She has a fantastic hit rate. Donnie Darko, Godzilla, and Requiem for a Dream being among her most successful suggestions. Oh, ooh, that's pretty cool, Grandma. But something about Towering Inferno made me averse to watching it. It had a cast I knew I'd like and a premise that seemed to make for a really exciting movie. Whatever the reason is, I didn't watch it previously. Hearing you two talk about it and its significance directly to me convinced me, and I really liked it. However, I am struck by the fact that outside of throwaway mention in The Social Network, I've never seen discussion of the film outside dedicated film communities.
Okay. You lost your place.
My immediate guess for this phenomenon was that the film was so overshadowed by Die Hard, which makes sense given the Roderick Thorpe, who wrote the book Die Hard was based on, was supposedly inspired by The Towering Inferno. Mm. They are very similar movies after all. Even still, I feel like I've never seen a movie so popular in the mainstream fall so hard out of the public eye. Mm. Although I suppose if one did, I would know about it precisely because it isn't in the public eye. So I ask, what other movies met the same fate as The Towering Inferno? Old movies, the older the better, that were hugely influential and popular at the time that people nowadays don't talk about or don't remember at all. Thank you for your fantastic podcasts, Jesse. Francis the Talking Mule comes to the mind immediately.
Yeah, I mean, those weren't like billion-dollar blockbusters, even if you adjust for inflation, but there was an entire franchise in the 1950s, a multiple film movie franchise. People wanted a lot of Francis the Talking Mule. Now, here's the premise. You stick with me here, because it's a lot. Francis is a talking mule. There, I said it. That was it.
Shocking.
That was enough. That was enough to get multiple films.
We don't talk about it anymore because it was pilloried by the Catholic Church for having an unholy talking animal in it. There were a lot of like really successful series that they just sort of milked into non-existence, and yeah, people just don't talk about it anymore. Look up how many Blondie movies there are.
Oh yeah,
based on the old comic strip. There were like five of those a year for like 10 years. It was nuts.
Now, to be
there
fair,
were
those,
so many of these Blondie.
To be
movies.
Fair, those were like B movies. Those were all like, you know, 70 minutes long, and they were kind of running concurrently with other features. But you still don't make like 24 of those if they're not popular. You just don't. Yeah. You make a couple maybe, but like, and then you're done. Like, no, people flocked to see Blondie, the comic strip about the beautiful housewife and her dopey husband who likes really gigantic sandwiches.
Mm.
You know, that was it. That was enough. That was enough. You could build an entire movie franchise based on that. One movie that this is actually a movie I've never seen, even though I know it's famous and it's critically acclaimed. But it is on the, if you adjust for inflation, it is one of the top 10 highest grossing movies of all time. And I have never, and again, this isn't necessarily the best metric by which to gauge popularity, but I've never heard anyone quote it. I've never seen it referenced sort of idly in anything except like one Calvin and Hobbes comic strip. And that movie is Dr. Zhivago.
Yeah, Dr. Zhivago was a big damn deal back in the day. Yeah. And, you know, our parents... Mm-hmm. No, Dr. Zhivago. But yeah, like our generation and younger don't watch Dr. Zhivago. Yeah.
If you adjust,
you might know Laura's theme, like the famous piece of music from the movie. But you, nobody.
Yeah, it's like really the theme from A Summer one. Place. Nobody talks about the movie anymore, but you might recognize the score. Yeah, if you adjust for inflation, Dr. Zhivago, at least domestically, outgrossed Star Wars Episode VII, The Force Awakens. Actually, hang on.
Yeah.
It outgrossed every Star Wars except the first one. That was a bigger movie. That was bigger than any Transformers. That outgrossed Avatar. Dr. Zhivago was bigger than Avatar when it came out. And I'm not saying it's gone. It's still, I think, reasonably respected. But yeah, it just doesn't come up. It's not very highly rated on the highest movies, you know, best movies of all time lists. It doesn't just doesn't get the attention. And I'm part of the problem. I've never seen it, actually. I need to get around to that.
But yeah, the Towering Inferno is a really interesting interesting choice, because the Towering Inferno was part of a whole trend of disaster movies that were just huge throughout like throughout the 1970s.
Yeah.
These ideas of getting a gigantic cast of really big stars together and putting them all in various stories within a big disaster scenario.
Yeah.
Towering Inferno, a burning building, an earthquake, a shipwreck. There was a whole lot of airplane crash movies. The Airport series were all big.
Airport was huge. The original Airport, which is a movie about an airline disaster, that's also one of the highest grossing movies of all time. It's pretty far under Dr. Zhivago, but I think it's in like the top 25 or 50, adjusted for inflation again. And it spawned multiple sequels. It was nominated for Best Picture. I think it won at least one Academy Award. And they're gone. All the Airport movies, they exist. Like, they're not like deleted, thank God. But like, those were, at least until the last one, those were huge blockbuster, successful motion pictures. And nobody seems to care anymore. Nobody, they never screen anywhere. Yeah. I've never seen, like, at a locals, and we're in Los Angeles, so we have like multiple, the American Cinematheque, the New Beverly. We have a lot of different local theaters that screen a lot of old movies. UCLA Archive, for crying out loud. I don't think I've ever seen anyone screen Airport or any of the Airport sequels. Yeah. They're just gone.
And a lot of more recent blockbusters are already vanishing. Do you remember the DC Extended Universe?
Well, I don't think all of
there
those
were like four.
I think some of those are well.
It ran for like maybe, but you know, because they the studio was so eager to just sort of restart that mythology, and because there were so many just terrible bombs, especially out of the middle of that thing, I think they're just sort of slipping from the mass consciousness in a really significant way. Like how people liked, people talked a lot about Justice League, and they made a big stink about how Justice League was, you know, not made in the proper way because the director suffered a personal tragedy and he had to step off. And so they spent all of this money to make this other version. And now that we have a new version of Superman, that whole kerfuffle seems like so far in the past.
Yeah.
Like something that we just is now a footnote. Nobody cares anymore about the two different cuts of Justice League.
I don't know if that's nobody can tell you. I think whenever it comes up, I think there's almost a universal agreement that for all of its flaws, the Snyder Cut was the better film.
I suppose so, yeah. But who cares about the Snyder Cut anymore? Who's passionate about defending it? It's only going to come up mm-hmm. in like footnotes now. It's already been pushed down the docket. Mm-hmm. And I feel like when you start to consider how many bombs there were, like Aquaman Part 2 or you know, Blue Beetle or Black Adam, you know, despite the quality of these films, these films are not really well remembered.
All the examples you just gave were like the last three films. Like it was like that. and the Shazam sequel, like those were not hit blockbusters that lost favor. That is a franchise that lost favor over time, and I don't think that's the same thing. Whereas I think some of the, like, Man of Steel still has fans, Batman v Superman, though still very divisive, some people are still, I think, really big fans. Heck, even Birds of Prey, which was a massive bomb, there are people, myself included, who go out of their way to champion that film because we think it's really cool. So I don't know if those are all the best examples, but I was thinking when you were talking about that, I feel like it's happening. I don't feel as though it's confirmed, but I'm pretty sure that this is happening already to the Michael Bay Transformers movies.
Yeah, those ones too.
Those were huge hits. Kind of like a lot of them made over $1 billion. They were very popular when they came out, and yet I don't think anyone gave enough of a shit about the stories to revisit them very often. It's not like people will get together like, hey, let's watch the Lord of the Rings movies over the weekend. Like, they still really care about those stories and those characters. I think when it came to those Transformers movies, those were such empty spectacle that a lot of people just wanted to go see empty spectacle. But 10 years later, they have no desire to revisit it because we have new empty spectacles and we have other movies that are both spectacular and good. So I think those are dying out. I think those are, you know, I like some of the later ones. I actually think Bumblebee is fun. I think the Transformers 1, the animated movie, is actually pretty excellent. But those Michael Bay movies are, even the good ones are junk. Like, the best Michael Bay Transformers movies are not good movies with a good story or interesting characters. Yeah. They're just not. They're just superficial. Yeah. And I think that tends to die out very quickly. So anyway,
yeah, for sure.
Anyway, that is it for We've Got Mail. Thank you everybody for listening. Thank you for writing in. If we didn't get to your email, stick around. We will have another podcast. Feel free to give us a nudge if you think your email really is important and you want us to make sure we read it on the air. Also, you feel free to send us another email, send our emails to letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. If you really want to get your correspondence read on the air, the best way to do that, to guarantee it, is to send something to our P.O. box. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
Yeah, send us to a postcard, a fully handwritten letter, whatever you like, to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Mm-hmm. And again, if you send us something to that P.O. box, we will read it on the air, unless it's junk mail.
Yes.
We do sometimes get junk mail. we don't read you like, oh, they're having a sale at Harbor Freight. Like, we're not gonna read that out loud.
Fun bit of a personal trivia about us. When we first got that post office box, we were still, for a brief period, getting the mail of the previous owner of that post office box, just, you know, by dint of postal service machinations.
Yeah.
And whoever owned it before us was a big gun enthusiast.
Yeah.
And they were getting all of these like super right wing Second Amendment gun rights pamphlets. It was pretty crazy.
Yeah, it was a real window into a different cultural experience.
Yeah.
But anyway, seriously, thank you everybody who wrote in. If we didn't get to your emails, we might get to it next time, or send us another one. Head on over to our Patreon page, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. For newsletters, bonus podcasts, all our yesterday Star Trek podcast, where we are reviewing every episode of Star Trek in order. We're approaching the end of Star Trek: The Next Generation. We're going to get to Voyager in the nearish future, not like in the next few weeks, but certainly in a few months. Also stick around because Whitney and I are working on a new project over there. We want to make sure we get some episodes in the can before we debut it, but we're going to have a new Patreon exclusive sometime early this summer.
Yeah.
Stick around, keep an eye out. And a huge shout out to all of our patrons. We couldn't do this without you. We wouldn't want to do this without you. And thank you for keeping a roof over our heads and paying our bills. We're incredibly grateful. We couldn't do this otherwise. And yeah, social media. I'm at William Bibbiani.
I'm at Whitney Seibel.
And that's the end of the podcast. Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney. Yeah.